Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. He was a news director of a radio station and the president of two music venues in Canada. In 2011, he moved to Detroit and started Detroit Bikes, whose mission is to make the bike-owning experience as fun and enjoyable as possible for their customers for the life cycle of their purchase. Their motto is, "We believe that streets are best explored on two wheels." And his name is Zach Pashek. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything is Possible. And we're talking to Zach Pashek. Since 2011, he's been the president of Detroit Bikes. Zach, welcome. An honor to have you.
Well, I'm very honored to be on this prestigious program, Jack. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, let's go back to Canada. Talk about your childhood, growing up with your mom and your stepdad, please.
Sure. I grew up with just a single mom until I was eight. When I was eight, my mom married a man named Alan Markin, and he was my stepdad up until I was about 23, I think. And so, I don't know what else to say about it.
What was the biggest thing you learned from your mom?
My mom really has always encouraged me to give people the benefit of the doubt and to try to see the best in people. So that can be a great thing to do. What I've learned later in life is that sometimes also you need to have a bit of a harsher eye. And you can, especially in business, you don't want to just see the benefit of the doubt in every person you're interacting with. So a good lesson in a lot of ways. And then, you know, there's a secondary lesson that needs to kind of follow it up too.
Sadly, Zach, we've got a lot of single moms out there. If there's a single mom listening tonight with one or two sons, what do you say to that mom?
Oh boy, I guess thanks. I know it's hard, and just need to feel. You just need to do your best. That's it, and you got to pat yourself on the back for doing it.
Okay. Speaking of doing your best, what were you like as a kid?
I like to make jokes. So I was kind of funny. I'd like to try to brighten my mom up a little bit if she was feeling down. But I was also kind of quiet and slightly weird. You know, I walked around sort of sometimes on my like tiptoes. I was kind of like a kind of prototypical nerd, I guess. I even sometimes would have like my finger kind of extended as I walked. So I wasn't like a cool kid whatsoever, but, I hopefully was entertaining at least.
All right. You've always walked to the tune of a different drummer, Zach. You're 20 years old and you become the news director of CJSR Radio in Edmonton. 20 years old. How did that ever happen?
Well, it's a campus station, so it's mostly run by volunteers and a few paid positions. One of them was the news director. But I was really interested in radio because my sister's best friend in high school, her dad had a radio program on the campus radio station in Calgary. And I thought it was the coolest thing imaginable that I knew someone who was on the radio. It just was absolutely exciting to me. And so then I started listening to campus radio a bit more and kind of got I felt like these were some pretty neat people on campus radio. It seemed like a good group. I was drawn to it. And so I really wanted to be involved in radio when I went to university in Edmonton. And I started volunteering for the radio station. I had a program that ran from, I think it was from 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. It really threw off my class schedule, but I definitely preferred the radio show to my classes. So I loved doing that show because you'd get some really interesting callers that would call in. And I could put them on the air. I could just do whatever I wanted. Sometimes I would play three CDs and two records at the same time and, you know, just mix them kind of in and out and make these sort of art pieces late at night. And I just had a blast with it. It was a great forum for creativity for me. And then that show, you know, eventually because of that show, I was asked to do the Friday afternoon program, which is where I started interviewing bands that were coming through Edmonton. They, you know, radio stations would always get these requests. And so the station manager there just kind of pitched them all to me. So I would do all the interviews with bands. And through that, I made friends with a lot of great bands and would go out and see shows all the time. They'd want me to come to kind of hang out with them while, you know, after they played or whatever. So I got to kind of know the Canadian music scene through that, but also just through my time, you know, being down at the station and doing that Friday afternoon show, I think our station manager took a leave of absence or something. And so the news director got put into that role and they needed someone to do the news director role. So I took that on and really enjoyed that experience as well.
Anybody who meets you says, man, this guy has got a can-do attitude. So now let's jump. You're 29 years old, 2010, and you decide to run for city council in Calgary.
Yeah.
What was your pitch?
Well, I was really interested in strengthening the downtown core of Calgary. I was running for Ward 8 in Calgary, which is represents the downtown area. And Calgary, you know, was suffering a little bit of the same thing you see in Detroit, only not to the same degree. But where the center point of the city sort of hollows out a little bit and everyone moves out to the suburbs. And there's a lot of reasons why people are encouraged to kind of go live in suburbs. But my take is that you need a really strong core to your city as well. And there are certain types of, you know, developments that can help provide that. So, for example, you don't really want surface level parking lots in your downtown core because it's not, no one wants to go see a parking lot, you know. You want to have streets that are really walkable and safe for people to be on. The idea of community policing kind of plays into that. You want your police kind of walking the streets and knowing the communities, and you want kind of community eyes on the streets. So, you know, vacant storefronts aren't very good for safety. You want, the best thing you can do for safety is have more people there, you know, so you want to encourage, you know, small business. And so, yeah, my platform was focused on just how to make the city as strong as possible and as sort of fun and safe to be in as possible.
We're talking to Zach Pashek. At the age of 23, he began running two music venues. When we come back, we're going to ask him about that chapter in his life. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Krasula. We're with Zach Pashek. And from 2003 to 2015, he was president of Biltmore Cabaret and Broken City, two different music venues. Talk about that chapter, Zach.
That was a blast. So after my experience in campus radio and learning all about bands and Western Canadian music and even, you know, Canadian music in general and kind of the touring scene through all the interviews I would be doing on my Friday show, I just got really passionate about that community. I met creative, artistic people who I enjoyed spending time with and talking to. And when I eventually was kicked out of school in Edmonton from the University of Alberta for poor attendance, because I was so busy doing radio stuff and so much more interested in radio stuff, I moved back to Calgary and I thought to myself, well, if I could help recreate a little bit of this scene and this culture that I experienced in Edmonton down here in Calgary, that would be something that I would find very meaningful. And that I think not only would I find it meaningful, but I think that many other people in Calgary might find it meaningful too. And so 23 years old, I was 22 when I started kind of looking for it all, but I set myself some goals when I went back to Calgary. So from my experience in Edmonton, I thought, here's what I need to do to set up my life in Calgary. I'm going to need to join a band and we're going to have to play a show at the Night Gallery, which was sort of the best venue in Calgary. And I'm going to have to be someone who, like, the bartender at the Ship and Anchor might buy a beer for. Those were kind of my objectives, that I could walk into a cool pub and have someone know me and, like, offer me a beer, and that I could play this really great rock venue because I was in a band. I think I had one other goal. It was like to have a radio show back in Calgary. So I'd achieved those goals pretty quickly getting back into Calgary. I guess they weren't that ambitious. But then I had this breakup that was really hard on me and I felt kind of lonely and wasn't sure what to do next. And it just, I was driving around and I got this feeling that, you know, I should put my energy and investment and time into something that's a physical place, you know, instead of just exclusively putting this into trying to, you know, be in a romantic relationship or something. Like I could build a thing, you know, that would maybe be beneficial for lots of people in an interesting place. So I saw a building that was for sale and just started going down that path and sort of went, you know, jumped off the deep end into running businesses ever since then.
All right. In 2010, you decide to visit Detroit.
Indeed. So that was after the political run. That was my campaign in Calgary had finished. And I was looking for kind of my next move. I knew I wanted to get out of the music scene a little bit. And I, through what I'd read leading into my campaign, all the urban planning books and, you know, just looking at different cities and what a municipal government can do to benefit a city, I got just very, very interested in Detroit.
From a fresh set of eyes, when you came here to visit, what did you see?
I saw the craziest city that I'd ever been to. And I'd been lucky enough to be able to travel to a few places around the world, and nothing was like Detroit. And I mean, that this was happening in the middle of America was just so strange. And then I met the most amazing people here. And I'd go into venues. I remember one of my first days in Detroit, I walked down to Slow's from my hotel downtown. And on my walk back, I popped into PJ's Lager House and talked to PJ for 2 or 3 hours. And he had such a passion for the city. The people I met, you know, just out and around were just so interesting. And the city itself had so much flavor, you know, even though it was obviously just the strangest place in terms of the, you know, the urban decay and, you know, the challenges that a lot of residents here are forced to deal with.
When I came to visit you at your plant, you made a lot of amazing statements. One of the most amazing was that you said, Jack, 18 million bikes are sold in America annually. It's a $6 billion a year industry in America, but it's all done in China. Mm-hmm. Talk about that industry.
Yeah, the United States used to have a lot of bike manufacturing jobs. In the 80s, there were a number of little towns that were sustained by the bike industry. And through the 90s, America just lost so many industries, and bikes were no exception. So in the early 80s, Schwinn went bankrupt. Cannondale kind of kept producing bikes up until, you know, the late 90s, early 2000s, but they were sort of the last one. They went bankrupt in early 2000s. So the entire industry just was sent offshore. And the result of that is that you end up with a product line that splits. So you get either a race to the bottom on price, where it's just bikes are seen as a commodity. A bike's a bike. It should cost, you know, $100 or whatever. It's just as cheap as you can possibly make it. Or then you have the specialists who are saying, well, that's not what a bike should be. I'm a racer and I need a super expensive bike that is high performance. And so that's all that the bike industry was really offering the general public, was either you got your worst possible thing. I say it's like Ladas or Lamborghinis. Like that's what the bike industry was doing. There were no Honda Civics. So, you know, it's definitely an issue for the country in a number of ways, from the product perspective for customers all the way to, you know, the loss of all that work and those jobs.
Okay. You consider bikes to be the future of transportation. Really?
Well, certainly. I mean, I think that bikes are timeless. So, you know, the bikes operate on a principle of a wheel rotating, and that's just physics. So we're not really going to advance past that. That's a truism. You know, that's a solid state thing in this world. It's sort of like trains. You know, I think trains are a great technology and we'll have trains for a long time. Ways to move a bunch of people at the same time from one place to another. That's a technology that, you know, we'll maybe innovate. Trains might get a bit faster. You know, bikes might have some changes to them, but they don't really need to change very much. And the nice thing about them is that they're powered by food. You know, humans will probably always eat food and create energy through that, and that we can use that system to power the bike. You know, I think that a lot of times with consumer products, people look at things as though there's always going to be technological improvements. But I kind of think that there are some natural things in this world that don't need to be improved upon. You know, a horse is always going to be a beautiful thing. You know, a horse is a great animal. We don't need a different horse necessarily. I mean, getting back to, you know, cars and those kinds of conversations, you know, maybe horses will be a mode of transportation of the future too. Who knows? But I just don't think you always need to be looking for new technology. I think the bikes are a great system as they are.
Well, 110 years ago, everybody owned a horse, but only the very wealthy owned a car.
Right.
Today, everybody owns a car, but only the very wealthy women own the horse. So,
Wouldn't it be nice to travel on horseback every now and then, though? I've never really done it for transportation purposes, but it seems very romantic to me.
All right. Since 2011, you've been the president of Detroit Bikes. Tell us about Detroit Bikes.
Detroit Bikes is the largest bicycle frame manufacturer in America. We make over half of the bike frames that are made in the U.S. every year. We have our own brand called Detroit Bikes that we sell mostly direct to consumer through our website. We also have a small retail store here in Detroit in Capitol Park at 1216 Griswold. It operates sort of like the gift shop to the factory. Our website that we sell our bikes through is www.detroitbikes.com. We sell bikes across the United States. We try to sell bikes that are very simple, very fun to use. We're trying to demystify bikes. Sometimes it's amazing. People seem to be more confident buying a car than they are buying a bike. You know, they'll buy a car with very little questions. They won't ask about, you know, safety or about what kind of spark plugs it uses or how heavy it is. Or, you know, there's a lot of questions people don't ask about cars. But about bikes, people seem to get really nervous. You know, they want to know whether they'll be safe on it or, you know, how many gears it has, what it weighs. You know, there's more trepidation about bikes for some reason. So I try to demystify the bike a little bit and just keep it a very simple system for people. I mean, we're trying to sell bikes for people who want to move around their city. They're not entering into any races or anything like that. They just want a different way to move around. And I think that cities are accommodating that type of transportation, which is nice to see. So we're making bikes for the people who are making the bike paths.
We're talking to Zach Pashek, and the motto of Detroit Bikes is, we believe that streets are best explored on two wheels. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula. We're with Zach Pashek. Since 2011, he's been the president of Detroit Bikes. If you want to learn more, www.detroitbikes.com. Okay, 2011, you started. What challenges did you face?
Well, we were completely in the dark, Jack. I equate it to being dropped into an old Victorian mansion in the middle of the night with no lights on, and you're trying to figure out how to get out of that building. Well, what that building is, it's almost like you kind of have to, it'd be like you were trying to repair the whole building, but you had no idea where you were. So basically, I mean, when an industry leaves a country, it's really hard to bring it back. You lose a lot when you just give away a full industry to somewhere. I didn't have anyone with any bike manufacturing experience that I could hire. I reached out on some message boards and was responded to by like custom frame builders who are quite elite, who thought my idea was silly. But there was no one from a manufacturing side who I could really, you know, rely on. So I found some auto industry people, a really interesting guy, Ed Summers, was the first, production manager here at the factory. He's a mechanical engineer. So kind of liked making systems, you know, kind of like big toys, but he was sort of perfect for the job because he sort of had as though like a Willy Wonka mindset to him and was excited by the prospect of trying to figure out how to make machines to make the bike parts. So he spent a lot of money and time building machines when things got started, because I didn't know that there were any companies that made machines for the bike industry. I mean, I didn't have any sourcing connections in China. I was coming from the music business. So I was in the dark, and I think to some degree the country was in the dark. And it took a lot of time just to get up to the ability to be able to make the bike frames. You know, just learning how to paint them took years. Just figuring out how to master, you know, our powder coating operations and how to, you know, tune that system properly. So it took some time. Finally got around to making bikes in 2013. Our first bikes came off the line. And I had this, you know, beautiful, ambitious dream that every bike store in America would be calling me nonstop. They'd be so excited about an American-made bike. And that's not what ended up happening. You know, we had a couple of bike stores who carried us. The bike sold extremely well through those stores. But other bike stores were very hesitant to actually carry us. And it took me a long time to figure out really why that was. And so in the meantime, I had to figure out what I was going to do inside of a 50,000 square foot factory that had all this capacity that we weren't really, you know, seeing the demand for it to be used. So I went out and tried to get contracts to do work for other companies. So we eventually made bikes for the New York City Bike Share Program. We did the 3,000 bike expansion of the Brooklyn section of the New York City Bike Share Program. For that contract, we just did the sourcing work. We did sourcing, wheel building, and assembly. We eventually got an order from New Belgium Brewery for 5,500 bikes. That was really the big turning point for us as a company. And we really were forced to improve our efficiencies, to get more people in here. We hired up a bunch of people. And so it's sort of been like that from the starting point. Start and stop again, you know, huge order, no orders. And then that's all really changed the past couple of years. Right now I'm sitting at a point where sales are no problem anymore.
Your plant, a 50,000 square foot plant, is near Schaefer and Plymouth Road. How'd you ever find it?
Yeah, good question. I found it through the people I bought my house from. So when I moved to town, I had a house in Calgary and a house in Vancouver. I sold those both. And a house in Vancouver, they're very expensive, little houses in Vancouver. I think when Hong Kong repatriated, a lot of people from Hong Kong moved to Vancouver and house prices kind of skyrocketed, just bringing in that whole new population. And so house prices in Vancouver are crazy. And at the time I moved from Canada to the US, the Canadian dollar was actually worth more than the American dollar for that short little window. So I was able to convert my little tiny shoebox Canadian house into American dollars to spend in Detroit on a house. And so I bought, you know, the nicest house I've ever been in, pretty much, let alone was able to afford. So I bought this beautiful house from a great couple, and they connected me to some friends of theirs who owned some manufacturing space. And it was one of their friends who had this extra building. It's right down the street from a building that they're currently using. And I walked through it. They gave me a price. I didn't negotiate with them at all. I just said, okay, that's a good price. I paid it. It was unbelievably affordable. It was very easy to pick up manufacturing space in the city at that time. And the building's been great. I mean, the building's in good condition. You know, power's good. Roof doesn't leak too much. So it's worked out really well.
We're talking to Zach Pashek. If you want to learn more, www.detroitbikes.com. You mentioned that today sales are not the biggest problem. Huge issue today is getting parts. Talk about that challenge.
Yeah. So hopefully this isn't too long-winded, but I'll explain kind of the predicament of the business model. So there are some real interesting advantages to being kind of the only shop in the US that's doing anything like this, really. There's one other place doing high volume assembly down in South Carolina, but their main customer is Walmart. So they're kind of in a different space. They have got a different set of, you know, relationships. It's a third generation company, yada, yada. But anyways, so to speak to the challenges, most American buyers who buy bikes from China would be buying the whole bike. So they need to go and they source one thing. It's a bike. But I'm sourcing the way that a Chinese factory sources. So I'm sourcing all of those component parts from all 40 different factories that are making component parts that go into that bike, which is quite a complex thing to manage, because all those parts need to arrive at roughly the same time and they all need to work together as a cohesive part of the system that is the bicycle. So people think that, you know, you buy a bike from a bike factory and a bike factory makes all of the bike. It's not really how it works. A bike factory typically makes the frames and they'll do the wheel building, but then they're importing, you know, 40 other component parts from wherever, it's nice in China because they're just getting them from down the street. You know, China has an industry. So the Chinese factory can go down the street to the people making the fenders or the making the pedals, and they can make sure that it's all going to fit together and work, and they can come up with a financial relationship with them. They can take them for dinner. You know, they can have that network built. I'm on an island in the United States. I don't have anybody down the street for me that I can go to buy anything. I've got to be pulling it out of China for component parts, or Portugal or Japan or Taiwan, wherever the parts are made, because they're not made in the US. This is also something that surprises many people. For example, America doesn't make any bike tires. America could, in theory, make a bike tire, but right now, if you needed an American bike tire, it doesn't exist. America doesn't make tires. I mean, it's just wild. We've lost everything. So anyways, the advantages to all that are that I get to do the final assembly close to where the customer is. So I can basically have that bike fully built by the time it makes it to the customer, which is a big advantage for direct-to-consumer sales. But my disadvantage is that I've got this huge sourcing burden to try to work out. So couple that with the fact that there's a global bike shortage. When the pandemic hit, everybody wanted a bike all of a sudden. So there are many places in the United States you can't get a bike right now. You know, I'm very fortunate with my business that I actually have inventory right now, that I have something to sell going into spring. And we're just trying to catch up and build it all. But basically, you know, everything I build is gone immediately. And I'm not banking that that's going to be the way things are forever. I know that, you know, a couple of years from now, supply is going to catch up and demand will probably lapse a little bit. But Detroit Bikes is such a small part of the industry as a whole that I think we can be a bit insulated from that. And really what we are proving, though, is that, you know, we're getting great reviews. People are really loving the product that they're getting from us. You know, for the most part, there's always a couple who find an issue, but we're proving out that we're kind of leading the industry right now for direct to consumer sales. And that's because of our domestic manufacturing capability. So we're kind of a little bit ahead of everybody else, I think. I think we're going to see a bit more of an onshoring movement over the coming couple of years.
Talking to Zach Kashuk, and I'm Jack Kasuli. And this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Jack Krasula, host of WJR's Anything Is Possible, the weekly radio visit, brings his 15 years of inspirational storytelling to hardcover. With God, anything is possible. Anything is possible. 15 of Jack's more than 750 tales of defeating odds and achieving the extraordinary. Like Bob Woodruff, whose job covering the war in Iraq nearly cost him his life. And Nick Vujicic, the limbless evangelist who has stunned millions with his message of acceptance and grace. With God, anything is possible. Order now while signed copies are still available at trustinusllc.square.site. That's trustinusllc.square.site. And as Jack says,
make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohom. I'm Jack Rosola. This is Anything Is Possible. We're talking to Zach Kashuk, the founder, president of Detroit Bikes. Zach, when you walked me through your plant, I thought there'd be robots all over. But you got 40 employees and only two robots. How do you possibly survive manufacturing basically by hand? It's old school.
It is old school. Yeah, we're kind of set up like a 1930s manufacturing facility here in a way. For the frame, we manufacture frames, but we also do assembly. So we'll also do the assembly and wheel building for bikes where we've manufactured the frames. But in some cases, we're importing the frames for other customers or for our entry-level bikes, and we're just doing the assembly. Assembly needs to be done by hand, but it's not that much labor. If you have a well organized assembly line, it should be, you know, no more than 30 minutes per bike. So if you're paying labor rates of say like $15 an hour, you know, maybe your full labor load is going to be, you know, $10 or so for a bike. It's not that bad. You know, that's basically what a Chinese factory charges to do the assembly on their bikes, but their bikes are coming off a line in a very different fashion than the way that ours do. And that they're typically not tuned in China. And they're also going to be put in as small a box as possible because they want to fit as many into that sea container as it gets shipped over. So we're able to, for roughly the same price, we're putting a bike fully tuned, fully built, ready to ride into a box. And so that service is pretty appealing, actually. And then, as far as the conversation about automation goes, I'm all for it. I mean, I think that there's nothing wrong with having robots do the work. And there's a lot of jobs that come alongside that automation. You go to a Chinese factory, even when it is highly automated, there's still a full sales team there and an engineering team and a design team. We not only lost the manufacturing jobs, we lost all the jobs that are above the manufacturing jobs. That Chinese factory also needs legal work and, physical space and everything else that comes with running the business. So it's I'm all for automation and that being a conduit to bring some of this industry back. For us, our automation is through our wheel department. We have wheel building robots. And I think this is just a great visual. I know I'll just have to describe it since we're on the radio, but imagine 10, fully built wheels. It takes up a lot of space. There's a lot of air. But if you ship the component parts for 10 wheels, so 10 rims and the spokes for, 10 wheels, it takes up much less space. So I think it's quite advantageous to ship those parts. It would be great if we could buy them in the States, but even if we can't, ship those across in that more condensed format and then have the robot here put it together, because you're not paying for labor. I mean, if a robot's going to do it on one side of the world or the other, why not have it be closer to where the final destination is, so you're shipping less air across the world?
Some people who meet you say, after 10 years, you're an overnight sensation. What's the biggest thing you've learned these past 10 years?
I have learned how persistent I am, I guess. I mean, it's been 10 years of walking uphill. It gets tiring eventually. The company's at a pretty nice turning point right now, though. I feel like this was always sort of the goal for me, was to put 10 solid years into it and then work on a succession plan or transition, hire some people to take it to the next level. And that's what's being put together right now. But I mean, I've learned an incredible amount of things. I mean, when I started the business, the idea of even going to China seemed overwhelming to me. And now I feel like I have a familiarity with that country and how to do business there. And I have contacts. The world has shrunk for me through this business, not just China, but the entire world. I mean, I have calls with people from all over the place fairly regularly. So that's been a wonderful part of the experience for me.
Your team consists of 40 people. Where'd you find them and what have they taught you, Zach?
Well, I find them from all over. So we'll often put out job calls and receive resumes. We have people who are friends of friends. There's, family members of people who work here will hear about us and that we're a good employer and they'll want to come work here. I guess it's not a takeaway of, I don't know how to frame it necessarily as like a lesson learned, but I've just learned how proud people are of doing this kind of work. I mean, the one thing that I've never had a problem with, here with this business is finding people who get passionate about it. Sometimes the passion, I guess, can be a problem because it can be maybe too much or, some types of expectations could come with that. But it's been, for the most part, it's been very easy to get people motivated to the mission of what we're doing here, which is quite nice. It's not like we're not like a financial services company that's just trying to make as much money as we can, through transactions. We're trying to do something that I think people who work here especially just really believe in, and that's pretty great.
You and your wife, Nadine, have two sons, and you and Nadine bought an old mansion in the Boston Edison District. Tell us about that initiative.
Sure. So I bought that house when I moved to town, and I met Nadine years later. That house, I have a thing for old houses. They were just made in a way that you don't really see anymore. And I love the woodwork in them and the attention to detail, the old fixtures and things like that. And so came down to Detroit with some money to spend from selling Canadian stuff. And just the prices here were amazing. You know, that was back when you could buy a skyscraper downtown for $800,000. The Wayne County building was for sale for $3 million when I moved to town. And that building looks like Versailles. I mean, and has incredible statues on it and things. So it was just a crazy, crazy opportunity here in Detroit. But so I found this house. It was really special and bought it. Then I moved all my stuff from Vancouver down to the house and it filled up one room. And I realized the huge mistake I'd made and how it would take me years to just furnish this place. So for the first little while, I was just, you know, sleeping, just on like a carpet in the den. And, at first, when I moved to town, I didn't have a car. And back then we didn't have Uber or Lyft in town. And the taxis were very spotty. I'd call a taxi and they'd just say, uh-huh, and hang up. And then a taxi might come or it might not. I would have no idea. So, and then my street, it was also not walkable. So the first meal I had at my house, I walked to a Subway shop on Woodward, bought a sub, big, you know, bulletproof glass. The person on the other side of the bulletproof glass didn't understand what I was saying. I mean, I guess maybe my Canadian accent was too thick or something, but I remember it was just a very hard conversation just to get my first meal. And then I, you know, walked back to this big empty mansion in Detroit and sort of wondered what the hell I had just decided to do with my life. But subsequently this journey has been absolutely wonderful. I've enjoyed every day of it.
We're talking to Zach Pashek. If you want to learn more, www.detroitbikes.com. You definitely walk to the tune of a different drummer, and your journey seems to always have to be uphill.
Yeah.
You're always climbing a mountain.
Yeah.
Why?
I don't know. I guess I like stress. I need it. I need to be around challenging situations, or else I feel useless or something. Or I don't know if I feel useless. I just get really antsy if it's static. I mean, that's why I had to leave Vancouver. It was too comfortable. That city is beautiful. I felt like I'd retired already. And here I was, you know, 30 or in my 20s, feeling like I'd retired. I wanted to go somewhere where I could get my hands involved and, you know, do something, you know, move something. And so hard to analyze myself deeply enough to really know why, but you are right. I do notice that about myself. I put myself in stressful situations, definitely.
As our time winds down together this evening, what advice do you give to a young listener tonight?
A young listener who wants to start a business, or just any young listener?
Any young listener.
Listen to your parents. Respect your parents. When you're young, it can be hard. You want to break off from them, you know, but I think that your parents are going to know you better than anyone and love you better than anyone and support you more as well when you really need it. And so, yeah, I would say try to listen to them. Try to filter through the stuff you don't like and understand what the kernels are in there that you really do like and value and take those with you as closely as you can.
Zach Pashek, thanks for moving from Calgary, taking a chance on Detroit, and helping rebuild the city. Keep up the great work.
Thank you.
Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohol.